microwave frequency will make it act like a solid piece of metal, even though it really isn't. As long as you understand what you're doing, you'll be amazed how many things you can get away with. You can cover a dish with literally chicken wire, where the holes are almost an inch square in the chicken wire. The chicken wire is only 5% there, the rest of it is air. Cover your spokes of your parabolic dish with that chicken wire. As long as you don't go above 400 megacycles, 27 inch wavelength with 1 inch holes, it acts like a solid sheet of metal. But the wind will go through there very easily. So, RF frequencies have got some funny things that will work that at first look like they shouldn't work. Over you, John, KQRIW.
PG2WG. Well, good information, and having a lot of fun with this. He's doing all kinds of bench experiments, and he's looking to cut the cost down because the copper and aluminum is starting to get expensive. But, alright, good stuff. The only thing I have left here is, that's it for the mailbag, but maybe after Paul, if you could describe, I have a gentleman, Mark, who came in on the chat room and would like to hear your description of something you saw and your family saw at your location there in Long Island that was in the air, and it was sort of like a UFO, and maybe you could give him a description. He's just fascinated with it, would like to hear the story. If he has time, KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that's a fun story, and I'll make some time. It's really a space story, and now we're going to go over the space section. Well, Paul's going to tell us what the what unidentified or identified flying objects can be seen from Munkankala. WS2N for the space report. Space report number 183, I think it is. Over to you, Paul, KQRIW.
This is WS1. I haven't seen any lately. We'll keep looking, you know. Yeah, Dick, the, first of all, you know, thanks for sending that one picture over of the moon from the LRO.
Might have to adjust his antenna, Dick.
Very, very high quality. I just want to mention a couple of things that, that NASA is going to be doing. In a couple of days, they're going to have a televised interview with people that are involved with the up-and-coming spacewalk. Spacewalk is going to be on the 15th of this month, so in the middle of the week. And you're going to have two astronauts, Tim Cooper and another Tim from the European Space Agency. They're both going to do a spacewalk and repair a voltage regulator that's been out of commission since November. So it should be an interesting EVA to change out this box. It shut down. They blew a voltage regulator, and there's eight systems that come into the International Space Station, and this one has been out. They would like to get that back online.
Paul, what I recommend you do, you're about 80% audio, 20% noise. I'd like you to call out some numbers as you swing your antenna left and right and see if we can make you stronger in the repeater tonight. WS2N, K2RIW.
1, 2, 3, 4.
What I'm asking you to do is, if your rotator is rated in azimuth degrees, say I'm swinging it clockwise, I'm now 270, 275, 280. We're going to choose the spot where you sound the best, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW. It's a little noisy right now tonight.
Coming through the air. Location. Yeah, I got some work I want to do on that rotator. So this, I don't want to move around too much. How's this thing?
Yeah, I think you're coming into the eastern input right now, which is also kind of noisy. Give it another try on the western input, but swing the antenna left and right and tell us where you are. And I think there were times in the past where you were good and strong when the antenna was aimed the right way. I'm back to you, Paul.
10 element first craft.
This should be good. 1, 2, 4. My guess is that's pretty good.
You went 1, 2, 3, 4, and you got noisier and noisier. I think you're going into the eastern input pole. I believe you sounded pretty good on the western input in the past when you got the antenna aimed in the right direction. Back to you, Paul.
Okay, I'm back on the western input, and I don't know. Maybe it's conditioned. We've got 55 miles down. I don't know. If I go any further, I'm going to point north.
Okay, can you change the aiming of that antenna when it's aimed to the west? I mean, can you swing it to 20 degrees clockwise and 20 degrees counterclockwise from where you are? Over you, Bones. Let's see if there's a place where you sound louder. And by the way, where you sound the loudest when you're listening is not the same place where you're going to sound the loudest when you're transmitting, because the frequencies are different. Over you, Bones.
Oh yeah, I get that. Okay, we're gonna start going further west. See if this does any good. Not only I think I'm getting worse, but like you said before, as a 6.
Yeah, that's not an improvement. Like you said, when you went further west, you got noisier. Back to you, Paul. Get another try. Now try some. Was that counterclockwise? Now you're going to go clockwise, so to speak. Go ahead.
USL. I'm going now. I don't know. I'm getting up to the north. That's about as north as I'm going to go.
As you went up to the north, you got noisier and noisier. Alrighty. Looks like we've, with that particular antenna, looks like we've done everything we can tonight on the western input. And now you want to give a try for what you can do on the eastern input with various antenna settings. Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
Now I'm pointing directly at the eastern repeater. It's got to be good.
That is beautiful. Whatever you did, you found it. Sounds good.
I'm trying to hesitate. I got to get up there. I got the RGAU cable coming down from the beam, and it goes through tape, you know, on tape attached to the mast. So what happens is, you know, over the years, it's slipping. It has slipped through that tape, and now it's very taut, very taut. So I've got to get up there and, you know, cut the tape loose and pull it up, put the tape back up, maybe put some strong wire ties on there or something to keep that loop. You know, I'm pulling against the boom as it turns, Dick. That's my problem. Mark that spot, Paul.
Mark that spot. That's a good spot. When you find a real good place to fishing, you put an X on the side of the boat to keep coming back to that spot. What do you, Paul?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm very close to the eastern repeater, but unfortunately, it was a 10 element beam, very narrow. What I really need to do is put an Omni up there and, you know, just throw a, you know, be able to switch back and forth. I used to have that years ago, but that's all gone. Okay, then. How's this thing? We'll continue on.
You're 98% audio, 2% noise. You sound good.
Do this on a regular basis, but I always like to work the work Glen Oaks. Habits like that really don't go away. You know, they're very hard to die. When we had the delay on there, you know, that was annoying. And then, they were always working on it. But now it's really working good. So I should do this on a regular basis. What I was saying before, there's going to be a news conference in a couple of days, on the 12th, actually, for incoming EVA that two American astronauts are going to work on. They're going to change out our voltage power regulator. It's out by solar panels, as far as you can go. I think they call it a P6. So they're going to have to change that out. It quit working last November. There's eight sets, so eight voltage regulators, eight sets of batteries. The section that they're going to be working on is an equipment section for that solar panel setup. And the equipment area is about 16 by 16 by about, I guess, about 16. And there's all kinds of batteries in there and all kinds of electrical equipment, all kinds of pumping units with ammonia to cool down the power supplies before they enter the station. They have DC to DC converters out there. They start up like 160 volts or more, and they eventually drop down. And within that group, that's where the power regulator is that they've got to change out. Where they have to change that out. But they think they're going to be able to do it quickly. And if they do, they'll be able to get some get-ahead work done and maybe work on some cables, data cables and power cables for the ITER. And that will be going up next, probably springtime. The ITER is the International Docking Adapter. I remember SpaceX had one on board that blew up back in June. So SpaceX is back in an operation. They'll be taking up another ITER that they rebuilt. They have to attach it to the pressure mating adapter. Once they do that, they'll be able to have commercial crewed astronauts to, be able to dock from the space station. They'll eventually have two ITERs go up to two locations. Eventually, they'll be able to dock two human-rated spacecraft to the American side. Russians can already do that. So, in fact, they could do more. Another note of what's coming up is the SpaceX will be launching a spacecraft that was supposed to go up last year, but with all the delays problems, it's been delayed to this coming month. That's going to be going up on the 17th, called Jason 3. It's really an ocean investigative type of satellite. And they'll be launching it from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California on a polar flight. And what's interesting about it is it's going to be the last of SpaceX's Falcon 9 1.1 version. They started off with a regular Falcon 9, and they converted, upgraded to a 1.1 and a 1.1.1 or something version. And then the newest one that was launched at the end of December, that's the one they successfully landed the booster back on land. And they're not going to call it the Falcon 9 1.2. They just changed it. Change that whole nomenclature, and they're just calling it the Falcon 9 Full Thrust, or FT. And that's the new version. Every one is going to be like that. So this one that's going up on the 17th of this month, launching the Jason 3 satellite, is the last of this group that they launched, like, I don't know, 15 of these things in the past. Was unsuccessful, and that was the one that went up in June that blew up the ITER, the International Docking Adapter, that they were taking up along with everything else, all the supplies that was going up there. So it looks good for they're going to do is attempt to land the booster, save the booster. Again, this time from California, in the Pacific Ocean. They have brought their drone autonomous barge that's floating in the Pacific Ocean, and they're going to try to land on that. What will be the first out there, of course, will be the first time from Vandenberg Air Force Base, saving a booster, and of course it will be the first time if they succeed to successfully land one on a barge. They've tried it twice, and both times it blew up. A lot of people are going to say, well, it's the 1.1 version, you know, they're not changing anything. They might have the same problem that they had back in June when it blew up. The cause of the explosion on that mission was the second stage. They had these steel struts in there. They were too weak. They broke loose during the high acceleration. They got the maximum Q. The helium tank that was being held by the strut broke loose, and that started an explosion and blew up the oxygen tank in the second stage. Well, to prevent that failure, this whole rocket was sent back, well, the second stage anyway, was sent all the way back to the factory in Hawthorne and rebuilt. They made that structurally sound, so they don't expect a problem. But they do expect to be able to land this thing out in the Pacific Ocean. It should be interesting. Daytime flight, it'll be a little different. The last one that they landed, Cape Canaveral, was a nighttime flight. I mean, it was an engineering marvel just to do it, and never mind at night. They launched at night and they landed at night. This thing's going to be doing it in the daytime, so if they're successful, the pictures should be pretty phenomenal landing on a barge. Hopefully not like the last two times they did it when it blew up. But each time that it blew up, they know the reason. They have thousands of sensors on these things, and they repair it, and they get better at it each time. That's the main information I wanted to talk about, and there's a few other things, of course, if you want to go on, Dick, but that's the main topic. There's plenty of stuff in the news. Virgin Galactic, they plan on bringing out their Spaceship 2. This is the one that's going to replace Spaceship 1, the one that got destroyed back in, 2014. They killed one of the pilots. New spacecraft is built. They're going to bring it out in the middle of February and probably start testing this spring all over again out in California. So, back to you for now, Dick. K2RI, WWS2N, Space Report.
Very fine, Paul. The picture that I mailed you, which came from Mike number 2, K1MJM, was done by, was it the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, I think it was the name of the spacecraft. And in that photograph, it's in orbit around the moon, once every 2 hours, and as the Earth comes up over the edge of the moon, and I'm guessing that's a polar orbit because of the way the Earth was oriented, you see moon terrain in the foreground, and the whole dark Earth from 240,000 miles away with a nice telephoto lens in the background. So you get this beautiful picture of the Earth with moon in the foreground, and it's not a composite picture, it's just a picture chosen at the right time. John and I and you have now seen it. You think of an easy way, Paul, that we can tell people how to find that website. I don't have that in front of me right now. Is there an easy way we can tell people that, hey, you just Google this set of words, or you go to this particular site and you can see that picture? WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Well, you can just Google LRL, Lunar Reconnaissance Orbit.
That's what's going on, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
voltage regulator, it fails. They have spares on board. They'll be able to change that out. From what I read, pretty much no problem. It's meant to be changed out, as well as the batteries. They have countless batteries up there. I think each battery weighs like hundreds of pounds. So you've got like, I'm trying to remember. Is it, I think it's 24 or so batteries that they have total on the space station. Each one weighs like 400 pounds, just under 400 pounds. So you know, your solar cells are charging these batteries all the time. It's one third of the time usually the space station is being eclipsed. You know, you're not getting any light in the solar panel, so it has to be a steady voltage coming out. They use these nickel metal hydride batteries is what they use to keep a steady state. But these regulators, you're averaging with the sun, you know, somewhere between 150, 170. Sometimes it's a little higher. 175, I think, it goes all the way up to voltage. And you need DC to DC converters, and they bring it down to 124.5. And that's the operating voltage for the International Space Station, 124.5. And the rest of the Russians, they run it at 28 volts, just like the shuttle, space shuttle, and you know, all the other spacecraft here generally run at 28 volts. But for the space station, run all those wires, it would have been, they wanted to reduce the size of the wires, the diameter of the wires, the gauge, and, you know, for weight, so they got miles and miles and miles of wire, which 124.5 is the operating voltage, and then they have, you know, they got a supply to Russians too, so they do have voltage, DC to DC voltage dropping down to 28 to keep the Russians happy. And the other way around, they raise the voltage up from the Russian side to the American side. Of course, they don't have the amount of solar panels that we have. But, you know, if all else failed and there was a problem, we could get supplied from the Russian side as well. So I know with everything NASA does, it's redundancy is a big word that they really believe in. That's pretty much it. You know, they're all cooled down. You know, you got the power supplies outside, you know, and they get hot. And to cool them down, they use these ammonia cooling radiators that we've talked about many, many times before. And one of those failed a while back, so they're constantly working on either on the ammonia pump systems or now once in a while these voltage things will play out. Back to you, Dick.
You said something very interesting. The Americans generate something like 138 volts or 170 volts DC and then put it through regulators and create AC out of it, I presume. And maybe it's 400 cycle AC, not 60 cycles. There, I don't know. But the Russians produce 24 volts. Are you saying that a portion of the International Space Station has solar panels that are dedicated to the Russian batteries that run on 24 volts? So they got a separate set of solar cells and a separate set of batteries to run their electronics. And out of curiosity, are the Russian solar cells on the east side or on the west side of the International Space Station? Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
Everything with the Russians on the tail end, we're on the front end. And if you look at the modules that are all lined up, pretty much most of them lined up in a row. We're toward the front, they're toward the back as they're going around the Earth. You could flip the whole thing around if you wanted to. But the way the International Space Station travels is the American side first, with all the big solar panels.
produce relatively small amount of power compared to these big panels that we have. And the numbers are, see, most of your spacecraft, like the shuttle, and then the Russian Soyuz rockets, and the Progress rockets, and, you know, all the stuff in general is usually 28 volts DC. That's what everything usually, it's been like that forever. A lot of our satellites, everything works 28 volts DC when we drop it. When they put the space station, they didn't want to keep the 28 volts DC because the wire gauge was really on the thick side. They have literally miles and miles of wire running from these panels through their, you know, through all the network of regulators and batteries. And they want to keep the weight down. To do that, they kept the higher voltage. So they produce roughly, that's between 160 and 175 volts on these panels. But they put them through these converters, DC to DC converters, and it drops down to 124 and a half. That's the operating voltage. And that's what's really coming out of these batteries. But that's the numbers. And it's DC. No, it's not AC, Texas. It's DC, 124.5. Back to you.
So since the Russian system is running on 24 volts, it suggests that for the same amount of energy in the watts, kilowatts, that they've got to have a much heavier gauge wire, so that the voltage drop on a 24-volt battery is more tolerable, whereas we're running 124.5, if I think you said, DC. And that's a magic-sounding number, with a 128. The main power line going into my community comes down Deer Park Avenue and goes up the Vanderbilt Parkway, and an automobile struck that telephone pole this afternoon and put our lights out for a while. And then when the lights came back on, I noticed that my UPSs were cycling in and out, so it looks like they had a little trouble adjusting the voltage at first. And I put my AC digital voltmeter on my line, and I found out that my line was running 128.6 for the next quite a few hours this afternoon, which strikes me kind of high. And I checked it with more than one meter, and I'm getting essentially the same voltage on two or three different meters in the house. I'm a little worried about my calibration. When I say 60 cycle, 128.6, am I reading a few volts high or low compared to reality, if you know what I mean? So I checked it on my Simpson, my triplet, and I forget what the brand name I've got for my digital voltmeter. But they all seem to agree, and that strikes me high. I didn't measure my 240, but if it's 128.5 on the 60 on the
repeater, timeout.
If one half of my house is 128.5, it suggests that my 240 is really going to be 257, which strikes me a little bit high. And one of my UPSs decided to fail. It didn't like that voltage. I'm going to have to replace that particular UPS. It's a few years old, so it doesn't bother me. But I suspect that during the accident, it received a pretty high spike of some kind that drove it over the edge. So they run on DC. So I think you're saying there is no AC power that you've been mentioning on the International Space Station. There's this 128 volts for American and 24 volts for the Russians. And are the Russians also using nickel metal hydride batteries? Have they ever had a failure of any of those batteries, Paul? Are those batteries happy running year in and year out under zero-G conditions? WS2M, KQRAW, and the TechNet?
Yeah, I mean, they're nickel metal hydride. I think they have, you know, 8 or 10 year lifespan. So some of them have been on there like for a long time. I don't remember if they've ever changed any out. I don't remember any spacewalks doing that. So Earth. I mean, they're going down in voltage and up in voltage 16 times a day, because they go around the Earth 16 times per day. So, I mean, it's being drained and up and down, you know, constantly. So, they're pretty good batteries, and from what I understand, they're pretty big. You know, many of them, you know, it's like 20 or 30 of these things, and each one weighs 300 pounds. One of them, you know, each one is like 40 inches wide, you know, and then like 20 inches deep. So that's one battery. So that's big. Takes up a lot of room, a lot of weight. They're reliable. The Russians, yeah, I'm assuming they probably have the same battery thing. I don't know. But it's not much of a draw. You know, they're mostly getting supplied by us. They have more power up there than they know what to do with. When the space shuttle used to go up, they used to, you know, put jumpers on and reach, you know, get the shuttle charged. And they're going to do that with Dragon and with the Starliner by Boeing when they start docking. And they'll be clicking onto them. They'll be able to stay on station up to 200 days.
Hydride batteries are outside of the living quarters, so the solar cells are out there, the voltage regulators are out there, and are these nickel metal hydride batteries, both the Americans and the Soviet ones, are those all on the outside of the spacecraft temple? Go ahead.
Oh yeah, if you look at the picture of the space station, you look at the 110, each panel is 110 feet long and 40 feet wide, and it's like 16 of these panels. So, you know, like, when you're standing on a truss and you're looking at, you look to your left, you see 110 foot long, and you look to your right, you see 110, you know, 220 feet long, just solar panels. It's almost as long that way as it is the length of the space station, which I think the length on the truss segments are like 340 feet or something. Now, where the panels, you're standing on the truss section, where the panels come down and they connect to the truss, figure that, you know, before they connect, imagine a 16 foot by 16 foot square, and probably, you know, about 4 feet deep. Let me drop it. I mean, filled up with these batteries, filled up with regulators, filled up with pumping modules, valves, all kinds of stuff that feed the panels, these radiated panels, ammonia radiated panels. I mean, all this equipment is in the middle of, you're looking at one panel to the left, one panel to the right. And at each panel, each section that you go to, and then, you know, as you go down the line, there's you know, four on the starboard side, four on the port side, if you're standing on the truss segments. That means each time you come to another junction, and you're looking at this 110 foot panel on the right, 110 foot panel on the right, in the middle are these workstations, these machine stations, loaded with all this equipment. So that's where everything's located, and that's why you have to go outside to fix everything. Let me drop it.
And roughly, do you know what's the total number of kilowatts of all those solar panels that they can generate, Paul? Go ahead.
They designed the International Space Station with all infrastructure being on the outside, you know, of the house. It would be like if you had, we're only going to put the pipes on the outside. We're only going to put the wires on the outside, you know. That's not going to put anything in the house. We're going to run them along the outside wall of your house. It's that type of design. Like I said before, they're going to go for a spacewalk to try to change out a power supply. If they have time, they're going to reroute cables, data cables, power cables, that are eventually going to feed this ITER, this International Docking Adapter, that they're going to attach to the pressure mating adapter. It needs power, it needs, you know, it needs data connections, it needs stuff. It's all fed from the outside. Nothing goes from the inside. So that's why they're doing all these paperwork. Add up the whole time, the whole construction. Apparently they plan on roughly 3,000 hours of EVA time in the total for this building of the space station. They managed to really cut back on it, and it's down to just over 1,000, I think it's 1,100 or 1,200 hours of EVA time. But it's still a lot of time. Back to you, Dick.
Paul, do you know the total number of kilowatts of electrical power all of those solar panels on the International Space Station can generate? Are they all operational right now, and when they are, how many kilowatts do you think is the total generating capacity? Go ahead.
20-something, but the, in, you know, because it's an average number, because they go into eclipse all the time, so they, you know, they're in shadow, so I think the average, they say the average is 85 kilowatt hours, you know. But I mean, they can go up to 124, I think it is. So it's a lot of power. You don't know what to do with it all. So, you know, what is it? 40, the equivalent of 40 homes. If you had 40 homes flying in space, you have enough power to supply 40 homes.
I'm punching numbers into my calculator. 85 kilowatts and 128 volts implies that if all of it was on 128 volts, that would be 660 amperes. Boy, that's a lot. That takes very heavy wiring. Obviously, I'm not looking at it the right way. That's a lot of steam. And all those solar panels are on a rotary joint, so that as the International Space Station goes around the Earth, and it stays oriented with a particular face of the International Space Station, always aimed at the Earth, if I understand correctly, therefore the solar panels have to rotate so that they stay aimed at the Sun. Isn't that roughly true, Paul? Go ahead.
To answer your question, you have eight sets like this, eight sets of solar panels, and eight power regulating sets. So one of them is out of order. So 1/8 of the system has been down since November. Okay, so that answers that question. They want to bring that back online. They don't need it, but they like to have everything available, you know. Especially when they get a little bit busier, they want to keep all the test equipment and experiments going. They have a lot of equipment that heats things up. Yeah, I'm sure it all uses quite a bit of power. I'm gonna say something about the batteries. You know, it is. Remember what I was saying. 24 sets of batteries. So that means there's like, 48 batteries throughout the International Space Station powering the whole system, taking the power from the solar panel, and then powering the ISS. But each battery is just under 400 pounds. And that's a lot of weight that's shipping up there. So everything is weight, and that's probably why they went with the higher voltage. They said that they wanted to use smaller diameter wire, miles and miles and miles of wire on the space station powering the whole system. It's interesting. It's a shame that sooner or later, if they live long enough, this thing is not going to be flying around up there. They're going to keep it operating until 2024. Back to you.
Okay, if all the solar panels are cranking at high noon, so to speak, 85 kilowatts they're capable of generating. Let's assume that on a good day when they're running a lot of equipment on board, they're really using 50 kilowatts. And except for charging some batteries, which is only a temporary thing because once you bring the batteries up to full charge, you don't keep doing it. And then on the next shadow period, when you go behind the Earth, you're going to be discharging those batteries. So if the real electronics on board is using, on a good day, 50 kilowatts of total electrical power,
And none of that is going into climbing stairs. It's not doing any physical work. It's running oscilloscopes and computers and cameras and experiments. If I'm putting 50 kilowatts of electrical energy, let me drop it, into my electronics on board, that on average, I am generating 50 kilowatts of heat. Therefore, those ammonia cooling radiators, those ammonia cycle heat transfer systems, has to be dissipating something like 50,000 watts of heat. That's a lot of BTUs. Let me think now. 746 watts is a horsepower. I can look at it as horsepower, or I can look at it as BTUs. Something close to 50,000 watts of heat has to be dissipated. That's a pretty big operation, Paul. WS2N, have I done something wrong here? K2LIW?
I probably did read it, but I don't remember what the numbers for dissipating of how many BTUs. Those panels, you know, those panels rotate too. You know, you want to keep the solar panels based onto the sun. So they do that. But the radiating panels, they want to keep edge on to the sun, so they're always 90 degrees out of phase. Now you talk about the spinning of the whole setup. They have the alpha, they call it the alpha joint. The figures are Volkswagen, and mechanized motor thing that spins the whole starboard. All the solar panels on the starboard side spins all the, and then the other one on the port side. They have another one that spins the port side. So they that's called the alpha joint. And then the panels themselves all have a motor. Each panel leaving the truss section, and that has to rotate as well. All the way around, they go back and forth, and they don't turn as much as the alpha joint, but they, you know, they call them the beta joints, because it's 90 degrees opposed of the alpha joint. So you got all these spinning things going on, and you wonder how this whole contraption is working. It's amazing, an amazing accomplishment, and you don't see enough. Yeah, I'd like to see Nova do a special on, you know, the operation of the space station. You know, there's so much of it that's not getting out to the public. Back to you,
Dick. Right now, I think the last you told us, Paul, is that the space station, International Space Station, right now is committed to something like the year 2022 or 2024. Is that roughly the number if they don't extend it? Back to you, Paul.
Along with the European Space Agency is hedging on it now. They might just go to 2020. So they have some financial problems. You know, they're pouring a lot of money into the Mars Exo rover that's going to be launched in 2 years, and plus this one that's coming up in March. They're involved with the Russians. The Russians are going to launch it on a proton rocket. In 8 months from now, we'll see if they succeed. They got a lander. They got an orbiter going into Martian space. 2 years from now, they have another lander with a rover going down. But they're pouring a ton of money into that. They're also pouring some money into the service module. They're building the service module for NASA's Orion spacecraft. So I think they're running tight on funds, where NASA, a couple of weeks ago, they were looking for, I think, roughly $18 billion or so. They wound up with $19.5 billion. So they wound up with more money than they expected. So they're okay. You know, especially for future missions that they have planned. K2RIWWS.
Pretty big operation. And as I see it, the major reason why all these craft are being sent to Mars is to look for evidence of a past life, living organism. We're seeing lots and lots of evidence that there was liquid water on the surface of Mars, although it may have been very, very salty water. But there's lots of evidence that there was water. And now I'm pretty sure they'd like to find microbial or plant-like or any kind of animal, vegetable, mineral life they'd love to find on Mars. Mercury, not a chance. Venus, not likely. Earth, obviously. Moon, not likely. But Mars has got, although it's an extremely thin atmosphere, it's got an atmosphere. It's got temperatures that are at least close to the Goldilocks zone. Good
job. Don't forget, Dick, we do have water on Mercury.
Yeah, but with Mercury's radiation and temperature, I'm having trouble believing that life would be happy there. Give me some words on water on Mercury. Is it on the, is it in the polar regions? How much water has been discovered on Mercury? I'm going to send it over to John and then Paul in that order. Tell me about water on Mercury, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yeah, Dick, Paul had mentioned that when I asked him that question, that they did find water in some of the craters, the shading, where the sun is not hitting it. And some of it is ice, a little bit of ice, but there is liquid water there. So we don't know. There may be some microbial life existing there. I know the temperatures are extreme, but I guess when they really start to examine that planet, that's going to be one of the things they are going to look at. Maybe Paul has information on that.
Yeah, do you happen to know the average temperature on Mercury? I suspect it's awfully high. And how much water has been seen on Mercury yet, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Dan, the sun is around 800 degrees, where, believe it or not, Venus is hotter. It's over 900 degrees, so Venus is further away. But Venus has that atmosphere and the clouds and the greenhouse effect. Still 800 degrees is no bargain. Sean, the Terminator, might have a shot. And yeah, I remember talking about the water that Messenger had, telling you know, they have neutron spectrometers or something on the air on that spacecraft. When that was in operation in orbit around Mercury, they found that, you know, at the poles, and again, that was a polar orbit. They found in the craters signs of hydrogen. Most likely here. Similar results were from the moon in polar areas. They could find signs of water that's located there. So that's what they believe. Reading a book, good book now. 2312. Pretty good book. Just started it. They started off. They've got a city. They've got a city on Mercury. I'm gonna see how this book works out. There's a city on Mercury rotating around the planet on rails, and it always stays in the Terminator, so it doesn't get too hot or too cold. 300 years out. I think it's more like 1,000 years out. If I'm back to you, Dick.
Wow. The main four moons, the Galileo moons of Jupiter, Io, Europa, Ganymede, Callisto. I think it's Europa. Isn't Europa the one that's got, it's covered with ice, but they believe that through a pretty thick chunk of ice, there's liquid water underneath. And is NASA building stage, the planning stage, are they trying to get approval to build and launch a spacecraft that's going to go to Europa, drill a hole in that ice, and start sampling that water underneath and see if there's life down there? Is there such a project, Paul?
US2N, KQLIW?
Close to it, but not quite. The drilling part they'd love to do. They would love to duplicate what was in the movie Europa Report. It's a pretty good movie. I like it. Europa Report. It's a little hard to find. I wound up going to the library to get it. They had it. And that's a mission to Europa. But presently, now it's in the budget because of the increased amount of money that they had. They had enough money planned to do 44 passes of Europa. They're going to go into orbit around Jupiter. And it's called the Europa Express. Because the goal is to get very close to Europa. So out of all these orbits around Jupiter, 44 of them are going to go very close to Europa. But because they now have enough money, let me drop it. It looks like there's a good shot now at getting involved with their lander. It's not confirmed yet, but they're definitely talking about it. Naturally, the scientists, go. And they'd love to have it. And they need to have a lander separate from the mothership and go down to the ice on Europa. What they're going to do there, I don't know. European Space Agency is very interested in joining us on this project, and they're thinking about funding the landing part of that mission. And because of the name Europa, they said, we can't just have NASA go, with the name Europa. European Space Agency has to be involved in this. So they really want to come on board, so hopefully that happens. Back to you.
Now, the main spacecraft, the main maneuverable craft we have on the surface of Mars, which is the size of a Volkswagen, is the Curiosity, which has been there now for a couple of years, making lots of good measurements and traveling around. And I think there's been a little bit of decay of one of the wheels, but I think it's in pretty darn good shape. Is this Europa Express at all alike Curiosity? Is there a slim possibility that we can get a lander on Europa that, like Curiosity on Mars, is going to go traveling around and decide where to drill holes and where to make measurements? Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
But you're not going to see a mission that's going to drill holes. Probably, for that matter, you're not going to see any kind of a rover. Maybe, if you're lucky, we'll have a spacecraft that will be able to take off and go to another spot, a couple of different locations before they run out of fuel. That would be good. I'm hoping for something like that. Drilling through what they believe is 10 kilometers of ice is not likely. That's probably for another generation. They'll send eventually something there, maybe nuclear powered or something, to drill through the ice and eventually send a submarine through the ice and investigate what's floating around in there, that ocean, a global ocean, see if there's any starfish down there or anything. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, so we got a long way to go before we really find out if there could be any life in that water. 10 kilometers of ice. Whoa. And any clues as to what's the temperature of water? I think Europa is being heated up by tidal forces as it goes around Jupiter. Is Europa the one where, on some of the flyby missions, they saw geysers coming off the planet? Is Europa the one that they saw those geysers, Paul? Go ahead.
Incoming off of Europa. You're thinking about probably think of the one that's been in the news lately is Enceladus, and that's going around orbit around Saturn, and the Cassini spacecraft has photographed that number of times.